Welcome to Who Knew? We are fans of the current series of Doctor Who, and here we discuss our likes, dislikes, and insights into the modern regeneration of the show. Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast. All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com. You can leave comments there, or email us at WhoKnewPodcast@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram and Twitter account. Tweet at us at WhoKnewPodcast, and find us on Facebook. Today's episode is episode 9 of season 8, Flatline. Two-dimensional creatures infiltrate a three-dimensional world. This episode is written by Jamie Matheson, directed by Douglas McKinnon. It originally aired on the 18th of October, 2014, and was watched by 6.71 million viewers. Hi, this is Eugene. Let's introduce ourselves.
Hi, this is Brian.
Hello, this is Frank.
Hi, it's Kelsey.
Hi, this is Josh.
Hello, this is Auburn.
Man calls the police, telling them something is after him, when suddenly he is absorbed and flattened inside the wall. Nearby, as Clara plans to leave the TARDIS after her latest adventure, its doorway and exterior get smaller. The Doctor searches the inside of the TARDIS and sends Clara to search the nearby area. She comes across a group doing community service, painting over graffiti art in a tunnel. They tell her that people have gone missing and their likenesses have been painted on the walls. Clara returns to the TARDIS, but it's now the size of a shoebox with the Doctor trapped inside. Something nearby is leeching the external dimensions and he can't move it. He hands Clara the sonic, psychic paper, and a combination eye-earpiece so they can communicate. She places the TARDIS in her purse and introduces herself as the Doctor to Rigsy, one of the community service workers. Rigsy takes Clara to the last location of the newest missing person. Since the room was locked from the inside, Rigsy wonders if the man is still there. Clara thinks shrink ray and shows Rigsy the Doctor in the TARDIS. Something begins to drain power from the TARDIS and they rush out. They begin searching the neighborhood for locations where others have disappeared.
Can I just say first that I want the TARDIS props?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a good size.
I thought the rolling, like you didn't realize what was going on at first when the Doctor looks, so they don't tell you right away. And then when you reveal to see the smaller door.
Oh, yeah, when he's like, that can't be good.
Yeah, I didn't even realize when they showed the door from the inside because of the way the lines were in the perspective. I still just thought it was like down a small hallway or something.
Which was different. At the first time, it was like, what is wrong? Why is it looking like that? Not really.
Yeah, not.
But it was. It was just, that looks so weird. Why are they doing it that way?
I like the set location was great for when they walked out of it. Kelsey, you had some ideas for how they would pull that off.
Oh, yeah. It only has three walls.
Right.
Yeah. So that they were able to like walk through it.
And they probably like garbage matted the sides.
But it was like, why didn't you open the other door? Because you would have seen
it. Oh, I see. They didn't open the both, like, they just open one TARDIS door to go out.
I thought that too, but you know, thinking back, they usually do only open that door.
Yeah.
But
they could have put a green screen up and
but
yeah, whatever.
What I really like about this episode is how there's a lot of visual stimulation, like a lot of visual storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when he looks in the camera, but like when they come out of that first small TARDIS, it's very visually aesthetic, and then just as the episode goes on, a lot of the fact of the and all the evidence that's being laid down, it's very visual, all the way to the opening gag of what happens to that guy in his wall, which I thought was very cool. And so it's and to a certain extent, it's something practical. It's not really a special effect. It's, you know, using optical illusion like we have on, you know, words painted on a street. It's something we could all understand and relate to, but it's still an interesting illusion. And I found this episode to be very inventive visually.
Yeah, and that cold open is kind of one of my favorite kind of cold opens, where there's something that happens that the Doctor and the companion are not aware of. mm-hmm. they are sort of a third party into this mystery. And then we find it's like fun for me to see how the doctor and the companion get involved in what happened in the cold open.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. This whole front section I thought was a lot of fun. I mean, this looks like a fun episode. You have some good banter and just the silliness of it. And even though it's a serious thing of people missing, but it just was really done well. But just it goes back to the whole story of Clara is now lying to cover where she is and not telling either one of them the truth, you know. And even the doctor said, let me enjoy this moment of not knowing something.
That was my favorite line.
Yeah.
But it also makes me, you know, solidifies my idea that the doctor knows she's lying. And he's just trying to mm-hmm. catch her in a to go gotcha kind of thing of, see, look what you're doing. But he knows. He knows totally, even though he was saying, yeah, I stopped listening to you a long time ago. He knows things.
Yeah, I like that the doctor is trying to solve a mystery here because it's now happening to the TARDIS, something that is
right
linked to him. And so, again, this is the doctor that I've been missing for half of the season. Is the one that is smart and trying to figure out something.
Yeah, and to that point, even though Clara kind of takes over the doctor role of the physical action of the show, he's just as present.
Yeah.
Like, I never felt like it was uneven between that, mm-hmm. even though she was like, you know, admitting to being a de facto doctor and kind of poking at him and stuff like that and taking the lead. And really enjoyed that moment. I know I'm jumping ahead, but I really enjoyed that moment when he realized, oh, I have to lie to them to keep them safe, which is what you do. Like, yeah. And then everyone gets mad at the doctor for lying, but now someone is now put in that position and understands. But yeah, I didn't feel like his presence was deficient at all. And I really, one of you was just saying that about the TARDIS, like the all-powerful TARDIS was being compromised. And so that's like an extra layer of scary. Like, what could possibly be doing this?
This season, they're separating the Doctor and Clara or his companion a lot. Like, even on Murder on the Orient Express, they were like apart for a while. This episode, I really liked it. And I think they used it to really explore more of what makes the Doctor by having Clara, you know, kind of deconstruct it. And like you said, make those realizations, even though we all kind of know that he always did that. Like, now we're like spelling it out in the episode.
Yeah. We're seeing it in a more relatable way.
Yeah.
And then thinking like, oh, that's what the doctor does. Oh, that's what the doctor does. I also like the visual gag of him being in her purse. Like, there's a lot of great business in this episode.
I do have a question for you, Eugene. When Clara's talking about the shrink ray, do you think it's a shrink ray? Was that a reference to the Master?
That's what I took as first.
Yeah.
In classic Who, the TARDIS has shrunk before, like in a Legopolis with the Master. So it feels like that the Doctor should have said that and not Clara.
Oh yeah, I think it was a wink to the fans.
I like how the Doctor is resistant to bring Rigsy along at first, and even refers to him as Pudding Brain. But then when he finally catches on that he needs to pay attention to what Rigsy is saying, he then is like, throws it back on Claire, or like blames Clara by saying like, see, you didn't want him or something like that. Like, you,
don't scare him away. Don't scare him away.
Yeah. Don't scare him away. And like, I got a laugh out of that. I enjoyed that moment.
And also Clara looking in the mirror to give him that, see, I told you so look. That just looked odd. That whole setup just seemed like a very odd. At the time, it made me think they're doing something, and I thought it'd be more story oriented, going, what's in the background? What's happening with this? Because it looks so different.
It was probably all composited because he was far enough away from her that if she was in focus, he should be in focus. I mean, he wouldn't be in focus, but everybody needed to be in focus. So they probably shot all those plates separately and composited them.
There was a lot of video effects and special effects more later, but certainly they were doing a lot of from actors in the world to like the fantasy world kind of transitions with their effects.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in addition to the special effects, yeah, I think the designs, the set designs really added in a efficient manner to like the believability of the world. When we saw the like the desert landscape that they're trying to tell us at this point, which later we learn is Skin, and Eugene, like you said, in the cold open with the perspective change of the painting. And then later, oh, Josh said that. Well, as Josh said earlier, with the perspective of the painting, like coming into the perspective of it, it's really neat. And later we'll see some other, like, just, you know, very efficient use of production design to sell what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because this is what happens when you watch these things over and over again, or more than once. The first shot, that's like the Scream sort of perspective painting. Like, did that get replaced by the Skin desert? Because I'm like, where was that? We never saw that.
I don't think that's the same guy's. Is that the same guy's apartment?
I think it is, because he's the last one. And then this is the last location of, or this is the newest disappearing person. So that's why Riggsy brings her to. It is, I understand that it is, can be taken both ways, but the editing to me says it's the same guy in the cold open.
We did just meet the supervisor of this community group in this paragraph. And has he been in anything else? He's like giving me real Freddy Krueger vibes.
Do you want me to tell you now or save it?
I don't, it's up to you. You're the host.
So that guy is, his character's name is Fenton, and he's played by Christopher Fairbank. He was most recently Olaf in Andor. You know, when they're in building the things, he's the older guy.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
And then he was in Aliens 3 as one of the prisoners.
That's funny.
He was the main doctor in The Fifth Element when they bring Lilo back to, like, they take the DNA from the hand in the opening, and then they reconstruct from that DNA the full body, and it turns out to be a woman instead of, like, an alien. So he's the main doctor doing that. He was in Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. He was in the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie as the broker that Star-Lord tries to sell that item to in the beginning.
He's also in the most recent one. There's a small, I don't know if you want to call it a cameo there. But and he may have been in the Christmas special. I can't quite recall. Mm.
But the thing I remember him the most, that's like kind of iconic for me, is from the first Michael Keaton Batman movie. He plays Nick. He plays Nick, and then he's the guy that says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm Batman." So he's in that very iconic scene.
Wow. Okay. Cool.
And he's really perfect. Good.
He's perfect in this episode because his character is so one dimensional.
Very good. Stealing my jokes.
I learn from the best.
That's very good. What is the reasoning behind him, this psychic paper not working on him? Is it just because he's dumb?
He has no imagination.
All right.
But I do like that his character didn't grow and change throughout the whole thing, because the psychic paper, he has no imagination. This is who he is.
Yeah.
And this is who he'll always be. It just was so different for a Doctor Who. Rather than just doing a flat one-dimensional, he embodied who this character was. You know, so you do have depth. You do have like a history of why he's like this. It just, I thought he did it really, really well.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it validates the point they made at the end that a lot of people died that shouldn't have, and some people that should have died lived. And
I don't really care for that
line.
His story arc, though, is really interesting juxtaposition to the boneless, as the doctor names them, because they both, you know, turn out to be kind of monsters that you give them the benefit of the doubt the whole way, and at the end, they're still the same.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I just Frank's, like, spark that.
At one of the locations, they meet a policewoman who then gets absorbed into the floor. They find her nervous system has been flattened onto the wall. Another mural is flattened human skin. It's something from a two-dimensional world trying to understand things in the third dimension. The door slams shut and the knob flattens to become one with the door. Other objects in the room near the walls begin to be flattened. Clara and Riggsy break out through a window and go back to the tunnel. There, the others are about to paint over the likenesses of the missing people when they realize they are the missing people. One of the workers gets sucked into the wall, so everyone runs to a subway storage area. The doctor tells her that the two-dimensional creatures are trying to understand the third dimension and may not know that they are killing people. Yes, they do.
I love
may
that.
Not. May not.
I love the effects in this this apartment, from flattening of the doorknob handle. It was just like, That's amazing. It's simple but effective.
Right.
And then the way
the carpet.
The carpet looks like bugs or like insects, worms. And then it takes the police constable. It's just really good. And even the way that the couch is flattened is very stylized. It looks as if the color is being, as if a painting is getting the color drained out of it. And for a kid's show, that is pretty terrifying to see the police constable get taken out of the story. Let's put it that way.
If I was a kid, a little kid watching this episode, I would have been terrified. I probably not would have been.
Me too.
I probably wouldn't have been able to watch this episode.
A very extreme version of Floor is Lava.
And
then you go behind the couch and then you watch the couch get devoured and you're like, I'm not safe.
Right. The woman who played the cop was terrifying when she screamed and was dying. I thought that in and of itself was like, wow, this is intense.
Mm-hmm. Well, them finding the nervous system, you know, is also kind of like with the murals in the tunnel, you could hope that, oh, well, the doctor will save them and release them somehow.
Yep.
But when you're like dissecting people, there's no coming back from that.
Before we watched this episode for this podcast, I think I had only watched it once and I didn't really remember much about this episode, but I did remember the nervous system on the wall. And I think it was one of those things where like you had that image in your mind. You don't remember what episode it came from. You don't remember like exactly the story around it, but yeah, someone nervous. Yeah. Like that is definitely an image from this episode that has stuck with me through the years.
So it struck a nerve.
Yes.
Now, once you saw that nervous system, you knew what it was.
Yeah.
But when you look at the idea of the desert painting in the other apartment, you didn't quite, it's like, that kind of looks like skin. Is that what that, but nothing, it didn't register what was happening.
All right. Plus they put that plant next to it to make it look more like a desert.
Yeah.
Coming into this apartment, you have the doctor giving Clara the sledgehammer, which is another great sight gag.
Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
Mary Poppins back.
Yeah, they did a lot of... Okay, so now that we talk about that, they had a doctor double, like a hand double, and somebody feeding Clara the stuff from her handbag. It was quite funny to see a guy wearing the doctor's coat, and then just, he doesn't look like Capaldi at all, and just like on his knees with the hand up the handbag. And then the scene where they get out of the apartment because the floor is lava, as the creature tries to take over whatever's in the room. It's a very coupling moment where Danny calls them in this moment of distress, but them trying to swing this hanging chair from the ceiling is making Clara breathe heavily. So Danny is like, oh, what's going on there? They get out and they crash through the window. And then instead of him being like playful about it, he's now concerned because he hears the crashing.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that moment with Danny. I think it was earlier, though, when he's on the phone with him and he's just like, it's fine. Are you okay? Are you safe? Are you whatever? As opposed to, you're doing whatever you're doing. You don't have to tell me as long as you're not lying to me. And are you okay?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Did it happen yet where the doctor calls Claire out online? Or is that later?
Later, basically. But he did say when she was talking to Danny, well, I'm helping a guy find his aunt.
That's right.
He goes, well, you're not lying.
Yeah, that's true.
So he knows. The doctor always knows.
Yeah, I don't know if I like carrying this, I guess, plot thread of Clara lying to Danny or the doctor. I don't like it going on for more than one episode. It's, I don't know, not needed for me. So I don't know.
I think the ending of the last episode, the Orient Express, and this is the non-existence of Orson Pink. She made a different choice when she had her and Pink marry, have kids, have grandkids. This is the moment where she's, you know, like I said last episode, that she chooses to lie to him and change the course. And that's why there is no Orson Pink.
Whoa.
So I think it's a little bit more laying this groundwork for her just becoming the hubris of her is what ends her, you know, and that's how it's starting here. And this is why I think a lot of people didn't like Clara. She was acting too much like the doctor. She was taking over the show.
It's weird. I agree with that. But in this episode, it's warranted. So I'm okay with it.
It started out as a fun episode. I liked it. Yeah. And if it was a standalone episode, that'd be great. Knowing what we know after seeing it all, it's like, oh my gosh, this is where they were starting to lay the groundwork. And we were not liking it without really knowing what we weren't liking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Until the end.
I think there's an arc going on between them that culminates in later episodes, and you need to stretch it out in order to do that. Otherwise, the point of what's going to happen between now and the finale doesn't have its motivation.
I guess I'm just thinking of...
Not saying it works great.
Right. I'm thinking of the overall resolution for it, and I guess that's why I don't think I need it. It's not something I will watch and go... Oh, this is where they planted that seed of bad wolf or Saxon.
And it's not really enjoyable enough. They're like, oh, this is the part where she lies to him every episode.
Yeah.
Like it's just kind of like, when are you going to learn your lesson?
Mm-hmm. Because like the showrunner was working through something maybe.
right?
This is like where my Doctor Who like faithfulness starts to decay rapidly. Like the next episode... I don't think I even watched it when it originally aired. So, I think I saw the finales coming up, but like around here is where like stuff really started to go south for me originally.
So you're skipping episodes, but you didn't skip the finale. And you say you didn't continue to watch the show.
It was airing live, but then, you know, if you missed a week at that time.
I know, but my point is that. Yeah. The finale is so terrible, you shouldn't have watched the finale.
I was trying.
Yeah, and I think that if I'm right about the storyline and her demise, it went on way too long.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's what I was like, it should have just been one episode type of character arc, journey.
That's what they did with the whole silence. It just kept coming back. Going, well, I thought you meant it was this. Oh, wait a minute, I thought you meant it was this. And then, this is what you meant by it 4 seasons ago?
Clarisonic's a speaker and the doctor sends a signal. The beings respond with 55, the number on the worker's jacket that was just taken. 22 is the next number they send, which is the number on another worker's jacket. He gets absorbed and the rest try to escape through the tunnels, but the doorknobs have all been flattened. A large hand emerges from the wall and grabs another worker. The beings are learning about 3D. The doctor creates a deflattening reflattener to help them escape, and Clara deflattens the doorknob and they run out. The beings are close behind, using images of the people to enter the three-dimensional world. The TARDIS gets dropped down a shaft during the escape and transforms into a cube. The doctor said that TARDIS needs energy to grow so he can defeat them. Clara has Rigsy draw a door, places the TARDIS behind it. The beings attempt to deflatten the doorknob of the drawing, but instead they send that energy into the TARDIS behind it. With the added power, the doctor is able to exit the resized TARDIS and says that the boneless do understand the pain they are causing. He uses the sonic to send them back to their dimension. That is, if they survive the journey.
I just remembered. So the moment that like Clara has Rigsy draw the door, like that was all Clara. Like, you know, she came up with that. Like Frank was saying, like she's smart. And like the moments that Clara bugs me is the moments where she's like, Doctor, what are you gonna do? And I'm like, what? Like, you know, she's coming up with ideas on her own. And I just like, you know, kind of, I guess what Frank, like, I prefer this Clara, like give me this Clara more. And don't give me the Clara that's just like hanging on the doctor. And like, I don't know. It's just like,
yeah. I also like this scene with Clara figuring out what to do, because we don't see it until they're actually implementing it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that It's that balance of, I'm not surprised, but I'm also not completely in the dark. So it's weird that it's in between, because you see the setup of what they're doing, but you don't know what they're physically doing. And then we see the result of what they did, and I liked it.
Like, I may not be surprised, but I'm impressed, because I, you know, yeah. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying, another great idea that Clara has is the Addams Family hand to get right. The doctor's like, I'm on the track. I can't move the TARDIS. And she's like, Doctor, you move the TARDIS. He's like, I can't. And she's like, no, like, you physically use your hand to move the smaller TARDIS. And like right before that moment, he gets dropped down that shaft. And there's like it's the older curmudgeon-y guy that drops the TARDIS down the shaft by trying to like hold on, like get it out of Clarissa. I don't know what was going on there.
Yeah, that was a real forced moment.
But when the doctor gets a hold of the doctor, telling what happened, she didn't say, you know, like, this bozo dropped you down the shaft. She says, I dropped you down the shaft. And I was like, it's just a one little line. And I just like was like, wow. And it was like, I just want to point it out, because those are the moments where like, and it's just like, it's just one little line that someone wrote that, like, you know, reminds me as a person, be like, yeah, sometimes, you know, I don't need to like point the finger, and like in a moment, you know, we can just, you know, relay information that needs to get relayed and then like move on.
There's also Clara's, this is where she realizes she has to lie to the people. Mm-hmm. And I also liked the, can't remember his name, the head of the...
The worker, community workers.
Thank you. The Fenton. Head of the workers.
Fenton.
You know, he said, well, who are you? And she came up with a great line that even the doctor seemed impressed, the one who's going to save you.
Yeah.
It was like perfect line, you know, what he would say.
Yeah, and then I think this is where the doctor says that lying is a vital survival skill and a terrible habit. I like that he added that terrible habit part.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that didn't work for me in this scene is the large hand grabbing the other worker. We mentioned the scream of the police constable in the apartment. That worked. This guy's scream, it looked very forced. Like they said, here's the camera, you have to scream for 10 seconds and maybe 10 seconds too long. Didn't look good.
I'm thinking about how that would have been shot with him standing in scene, like the way that we see it, he's with a group of people and then the hand comes from behind him, grabs him, pulls him back, but the camera stays with him. Mm-hmm. So that's like a seamless shot to the audience. So whatever green screen he was on, you know, the camera is probably the same distance as it was on set from the other actors. But then the camera has to rush in and go above him because we see his head being held by the hand as it's being drawn back. So yeah, that would have probably been very difficult for the actor to do all those emotions.
Yeah.
With all the camera work and like getting the green screen. Like, so I'm sure that was a very difficult shot. But yeah, just story-wise, that was out of character with the rest of what we see later with the boneless. But it's fun.
Well, that was leading up to the aha video of Take On Me, Take Me Home, Take Me On. Everybody started coming in, that kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of that, the boneless, the way they manifest in three dimensions, I love that. It's very much like a stop motion staccato quality that reminds me of like Harryhausen and horror stuff. So I don't know if that was an intentional tribute, but I liked it.
Yeah, and that's just what makes the contrast to that hand even worse.
Because it doesn't look as good.
It's like, you have cool stuff. Yeah, why even?
And then you could see the mask that they were wearing of the people that they had just killed. I love that.
Right.
I mean, to me, it didn't look any worse than 80% of the usual Doctor Who effects. It's just the other effects in this episode were very good. And so it just paled in comparison. But one of my favorite things was when they figured out... he made the TARDIS and to, you know, unflatten and then reflatten. I like it when stories use the bad guy's own own properties against it. Like, they didn't have to come up with something new. They actually just used what it was to put the opponent in, at a disadvantage.
Well, my problem with that is then you have a new rule number one. Frank, you want to say that a new
rule? No, go ahead. You go ahead.
use your enemy's powers against you is the new rule number one, where before it was rule number one, the doctor lies. And then before that, it was rule number one, wait 5 hours from a girl in the fireplace when they got separated.
Right.
But as a podcast, we're like keeping track, or at least I'm keeping track of these things.
but that's consistent.
Oh, I know.
The doctor lies about what rule number one is. We don't know what rule number one is.
I'm being pedantic and
he's lying.
Literal in this case.
And it's Claire saying it, right? Like she's lying. Yeah, to she's the one that says it. To tell
so she the
like,
doctor.
She's just telling them.
Oh,
the
she's the one who says that. That's rule number one. Yeah. I missed all that.
Yeah, she's the one that makes the new rule. Did anybody notice the number of the first train that comes in?
No.
Well, it was just popped on my little screen here. A113.
Yeah, A113.
Isn't that the Pixar?
yeah. It's an animation in joke that I think at first originated in Amazing Stories, The Family Dog. And then it's shown up since then in mostly Pixar movies because it's a classroom number at California Institute of the Arts.
Hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, where that
I did
that
not see that. I was just thinking, what? You created a deflattener, reflattener? Just, okay, well, that's convenient.
It also just goes, little, bing!
Right. It just was a little bit too much. When we first saw the whole mural, you know, around there was a wall that had handprints and footprints and maybe like little smudges, like where your shoulder would lean up against the wall or whatever. And I was wondering at this point, because we know or believe that the boneless are evil and they're just killing us, what impact do we have on the second dimension world? What happens when we step down, when we put a hand down, when we step on something? Well, have we killed them without even knowing it?
Right.
That's how they see us at first. It's like we're just stepping on them two-dimensionally. So they're kind of documenting what they see of us, maybe, in that, well, you know, on that wall.
Or that was them trying to communicate back. You know,
right,
they've been hearing us in that way, and then they're trying to talk back to us.
Right.
But we're not.
Like, well, if they're not going to talk back, then we'll just kill them.
Yeah.
Well, Frank, you bringing that up reminded me of a book called Flatland. I don't know if anybody's talked about or heard about that, where it's a two-dimensional world, and then all of a sudden there's this this large object that comes from the sky and then takes over everything and then goes smaller and goes away, and then that's a ball being bounced on a flat surface.
I remember that from Cosmos.
When one thing that I, you know, we come up with our dream scenarios for these episodes, but like now that we're at the end, you know, a monster of the week is always fun, but I think it would have been very interesting to dive more into how to communicate with these creatures, especially when you had Riggsy, who was doing 2D art, and then instead of using his artwork as a way to communicate, it was just another way to deceive and, like, kill. But, you know, you can't have it all. It's only an hour, and it's for kids. But that was, like, just such a... And especially for the Doctor, you know, Doctor Who, sci-fi in general, I like it when it uplifts. I know sometimes you have to have the horror element, but this was one where it was like, even they were hoping that there was something good with them, and then just to make them monsters is like, okay. Like, there was no stretch of humanity or the imagination.
I will go ahead, Frank.
How did they know about 22? It's part of the third dimension. They haven't gotten to what that number could be. They didn't see it.
Oh,
I mean, the script needed it.
You know, that's one thing that's like nitpicky, yes. But it was a warning going, we're coming after this person next. Yeah. I get that, and that worked out well. It was only in retrospect that you think, how did they know about 22?
Well, they could see it, couldn't they? They picked him.
But not at this point. They weren't three-dimensional yet.
Yeah, but they were slowly beginning to get it. So it's like they couldn't be three-dimensional, but they could probably see into the three-dimensional world at that point.
Okay.
So they were using their newfound skill to impress. Impress. Huh, that's funny.
you also mentioned that the main character was in Aliens 3. I don't know if anyone else, but I got a lot of Alien vibes because the Doctor was watching that screen.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in Aliens, like the Marines all have cameras that are sending back. So I just that kind of feeling with that horror, and especially once we're in the tunnels and it's darker, I got some aliens.
For sure, yeah.
And that also with the perspective, you know, having the doctor watching everything on a flat screen, like, makes it easier to sell some of those effects, especially 22 George, right? When the perspective changes and you see he's like imprinted perspective wise on the wall behind him.
That was very cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
I really like that idea. I thought it was great, even though I agree with you, Auburn. But as an artist, just because you can paint graffiti doesn't mean you can paint a convincing three-dimensional trompe-l'oeil door. and maybe it's just like, yes, you have to just stretch your imagination if you have one, or suspend your disbelief. But that's one thing, like, that artists see, like, everyone sees when their trade is portrayed in a show, it's always not quite right. No, that's not how that works.
Well, maybe Rigsy's the one that went to Cal Arts.
I mean, not to say, but yeah, I mean, if that was their explanation, so, like, see, he's not just a tagger. He's actually an artist. Then that's fine. But it didn't occur to me while I was watching it. It occurred to me as I was thinking about it just now.
Yeah, and only later, why were they going for that door anyways? Like, what was up with that door that they thought they had all gone through?
Yeah.
I mean, you also don't want to think too deeply about it, because they're on the opposite side of a wall. How did they get to the other side to know that where to put that, and to have the door handle turn knob thing to be right where that little ledge for the cube is going to be? Yeah. But anyway,
I mean, the Tesseract.
But I was just going to say, when the TARDIS came back to life, I have a real triumphant moment, real geek out moment.
But instead of the Tesseract, it made me think of the Doctor's wife. Mm-hmm. That was the
Ouroboros.
I got mail.
What?
I got mail.
I don't get what you're mean.
The cube.
Yes, you know, it's with
mail.
The memories and the thing for the Doctor, or from any Time Lord. You know, so they had all those cubes that the planet was eating and killing. It's like, so is that why it shrunk down? It's like, this is the last of the Doctor. This is his goodbye. Was that what that meant?
Well, he was losing air.
He put it into like safety mode or just
siege
survival
mode.
Siege mode. So it would be protected or something.
My question on that is, if the TARDIS hadn't already shrunk when he went into siege mode, would the cube have been more larger? Yeah.
I didn't think about it.
And my theory would be no, because that's what, when the Time Lords are in desperation, it goes down to the cube anywhere to try and save power, to try and do as much as it can. And then when it dies, then it's transformed into their, you got mail. That's what you mean by you got mail. I remember the episode now. Sorry, Brian. Which, why there wasn't the, you know, the bells.
The cloister.
But it just seems, just by being the cube, reminded me of that, and I wanted a better tie-in, I guess. I wanted more information on that.
Wasn't there a cloister bell as the TARDIS fell back onto the track? Then there was like a cloister bell there that went off as he was pulling the siege mode? Like,
I'm not sure, I'd have to listen again, but I'm going to buy it. I'm going to buy it.
There's also a lot of sound design going on there.
There's a lot. I think after he gets his little dance in where he's like safe, then it falls back, and then it's imminent danger. And I think that's when the cloister bell is going.
Yeah, so as he started dancing, and then you kind of hear the bong, and then it happened a few times. And I think the last time was when it had fallen, and we see the little TARDIS with his face in there.
Yeah.
But thank you, Albert. Yes. Perfect.
Yeah, there's a lot of other noise going on.
Yeah, there's the theme going on. There's a lot. But I'd like to go back to Auburn, what you said about Rigsy using his art to kind of uplift humanity, or just like end more on a positive note. I think what they did is they wanted to make that return of the Doctor triumphant, because he's talking, like, his speech is a speech. Like, so they're building up to that moment, which is unfortunate that they had to sacrifice for a more moral high groundy type of ending. Because it reminds me of the Christmas Invasion, where you're kind of missing the Doctor for most of the episode. And so when he comes back at the end, like, you build up to that. And like the 12th Doctor coming out and saying, this plane is protected. Like, Yes, that's what the doctor does. He says, this is the planet I protect. And then what I do like, though, is what makes it okay for me that the boneless are something that we don't want to build a new, like, relation new, with. Or yeah. Just, he says that we've tried to understand, reach out and talk to you, but you're determined to be monsters. That's the role you're determined to play. I like that. He's like, okay, that line makes it acceptable. That that he says next is like, I'm then going to play my role, the man who stops the monsters. And then he sends them away.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is kind of like the beginning of how almost every episode ends, in a proclamation speech, you know, and we'll eventually reach the point where it's like an entire two-part episode exists just so the doctor can say his speech at the end.
and for some reason, this one I like because it was built up that the doctor is separated from Clara, and then the other ones are like not as earned, I guess.
Well, he's also just so good at doing it.
Can we talk about the train operator who just wants to ram something?
I found him to be the most relatable.
It was nice to bring in a new character then and then not really do much, but he was a full character. It was like, great.
Yeah.
Yep. I just like how he goes, are you from MI5? I'm not going to question it, but if I can ram something, that's all I need, the verbal. I just need the verbal.
Wait, anyway. I didn't ask at the beginning, is there any significance to Bristol other than its distance from where Clara wants to be?
Considering you just asked that, one of the more commonly used thicker forms of artist paper is Bristol board.
Oh, what a connection.
Yeah, so could be.
They're famous for their 2D.
There's also Cardiff paper, but you know, I never said that.
Clara says that she did good as the doctor, but why can't the doctor just say it? The doctor says she did well, but goodness had nothing to do with it. The mysterious Missy is watching and tells herself she picked well when choosing Clara.
That was like a nice little tag of, we forgot about her.
Yeah.
But then now in context, it's completely different from what we've seen before.
Has nobody died?
Wasn't she at the end of the last episode?
Mummy? No, that's the thing we complained about.
Okay, right. Then maybe, because I watched the two episodes, maybe I just got confused that the first one was from, what? Go on.
It was fun that she had like a off-the-shelf iPad that she was looking at.
What camera feed was she tapped into? Good Lord.
They didn't dress that up at all.
Like, not even the camera, it's like right up, yeah.
I know. She couldn't have held it upside down and like had her thumb over it maybe or something.
I mean, the BBC can't cut a piece of plastic in a cool shape. And yeah.
You know what? It might have been product placement for all we know.
Ooh, like, could have been.
Like, this only
sponsored,
like,
this episode.
Maybe.
I will say that this, before we get to the Missy tag, this is kind of my favorite, like, artistic-y sort of blocking with Fenton just walking away, and he stays in the background as Rigsy is saying goodbye to Clara and the doctor. I just like that you can see him keep walking.
That's a nice touch.
No, I like the ending with them. They've been doing this too. I mean, I guess you always have to have an ending, but you know, saying goodbye to all of the characters we met along the way, seeing if they grew or not. But this was good, because you had, like you said, the train operator, who was a fresh character into the story, and then Rigsy and
Fenton.
Thank you.
And I also like the way they handled the characters believing what the Clara or the doctor or whoever, what's going on. And it always tends to work, but sometimes it's just like, why would they believe them? And this is an example of something was actually happening that is unbelievable, but it's actually happening. So they have no recourse but to believe it happening, and someone standing there that isn't thrown by it. So of course they're going to listen. Like, they have no choice but to follow the person who's leading, which breaks that, you know, suspension of disbelief of like, why on earth would I believe what's happening and believe you? Because they have no choice. So this was done very well in this episode.
Agreed. But now it made me think that Fenton is like, that didn't happen. He's just gonna He's gonna reject it all now. He's walking away.
Right. In his brain, he's like, "That's too imaginative. Get rid of it. Get rid of it."
It's like, I don't know what you drugged me with, but it's not gonna happen.
He's just gonna fill out his reports on how he lost half his community cleanup crew. And yep.
They killed each other.
Yeah, right. How's he gonna...
And then his next report is requesting new community.
He's probably going to be fired because people died under his supervision. You're right. He's not that I thought you were wrong, but he's still walking in the background. But so we didn't have to see him, but there he is. He's like this big in the background.
That's why I found it like, oh, you're really like committed to that.
Well, that's where craft services was. So he was just on the way there.
Should I share my hot take, Auburn?
Yeah, you should.
Okay. So all I want, the only thing I had to add about this episode is that the BBC are a bunch of cowards.
Because
the scene in when Rigsy jumps in the train to ram it, to give everyone time, and Clara jumps on after him because she doesn't want him to, you know, do this big sacrifice because it's unneeded. And she has that moment with the hair tie. Well, I was just going to use this hair tie, but I'll always remember you as every time I look at it, I always remember your sacrifice for my hair tie. Like that's good writing. Like it was okay writing. But the way that it was acted by Jenna Coleman just made that moment great. And that is the moment I watch that and I say, that's the Doctor. That's the Doctor reminding us that there are no small characters. And if they had just had Clara be the impossible girl and exit, so they could have had Jenna Coleman come back as the Doctor. And I think she would have been phenomenal. But I think the BBC was like, it's too soon. The world's not ready for a female doctor yet. And we were. And Jenna Coleman would have been amazing. And that's why I say BBC are a bunch of cowards.
But the next doctor was female.
Right. But Jenna Coleman should have been the 12th doctor, is what I'm saying. Like Jenna, right.
Okay, I get
like
it.
Clara should have ended as the impossible girl who went into the time stream and got separated and saved the doctor. The doctor should not have been able to save her. That would have been the end of her storyline. We all would have been sad. And then Rory and Amy and the 11th doctor would have played out. And then 12th doctor, and it's Jenna Coleman. And we're all like, what? The impossible girl is now the doctor. And then Jenna Coleman just would have done more moments like the moment in the train car with Clara and Rigsby, and we would have been on this journey with the first female doctor, and I think it would have been just great. And so
there's material for your fan fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
There's always rumors whenever like a doctor ends and a new doctor is coming. Do you remember with the switch between Smith and Capaldi, were there any other like names in play? Or I know sometimes it can get more like,
there's always names.
They better not do this person, but yeah.
Yeah, they always, I think Idris Elba was mentioned.
Always mentioned.
Yeah. They made a big, huge deal out of Capaldi.
Okay.
They even had like a half hour reveal special for him.
Yeah, it was the weird name. I mean, Capaldi did well. I mean, you're saying, I mean, that's the only thing I have an issue with is like, well, then we wouldn't have any Capaldi, you know, but then she would be the doctor for the 50th, which I don't think they, you know, so it's the real world aspect of it. Ugh. But I think that's an interesting idea. I do like, it's just sort of, we would still have that half season with her and Matt.
Yeah. I mean, it just came to me today. So it's not like a fully formed thought. You know,
no, but I never thought of that.
It is a hot take. It's just something I thought watching that scene and loving that scene and being like, I want more of this. I wish I could have more of this. And if she was the doctor, like if she was actually the doctor, then we would have more moments like that.
In the Doctor Who multiverse, it could have happened. Eugene's right. You should write your fanfic.
You should.
I like these alternate ideas. This is pretty good.
The writer, Jamie Matheson, his idea with the cube and the siege mode, he said that he'd never seen the TARDIS in a pre-chameleon circuit stage. So his idea was that this is how all TARDISes start out as a cube, and then they get formatted or whatever into with whatever the Time Lord wants it to be. So he that was his like sort of fan fiction put into canon, sort of. But I don't know if it's canon because we see in the 50th, Is it the 50th?
It's the 50th.
With the like a cylinder tube as opposed to a cube.
No, it's not the 50th. It's the Impossible Girl.
That's what it is. Okay.
The one right before the 50th.
All that. Anyway, that's what the writer wanted to do. All right, going through the cast real quick, we have Jovan Wade as Rigsy. He is Victor Stone, aka Cyborg, in Doom Patrol and Legends of Tomorrow. We will see him again in Doctor Who. Wow. John Cummings plays Roscoe. He was an innkeeper in The Witcher. Jessica Hales plays PC Forrest. Matt Bardock plays Al. Raj Bajaj plays George. James Quinn plays Bill. And then we talked about Christopher Fairbank earlier. Flatline. Who is this episode good for? Or more specifically, this episode is good for who? A new viewer, a casual viewer, fan of the show, or a diehard?
You know, I often am very precious about my new Who. I could almost see this one being good because it is so self-contained. Also, like the TARDIS, you know, you're there a lot, so it's great to get all that TARDIS time. Yeah, I'll say new, because I think like I bring a lot of baggage to this point in the story that I don't think a new person would bring necessarily, but it is fun. Like all the gags with the purse and the small TARDIS are fun. The ending, it's intriguing. Yeah, I'll say new Who viewer.
I agree. I think it's encapsulated. Anything that someone knows more about doesn't really affect the story, and you know what you don't know won't hurt you, sort of thing. And there is enough of the dog. There's enough of everything that we like about it to be in there, and it's a good episode, you know, to boot, you know, on its own of television.
Yep, that's what I was gonna say. Everything that you guys discovered, I would recommend this for a new viewer because, like Eugene mentioned, this is a doctor that is very familiar. Like this doctor tracks throughout all of Doctor Who. He's acting the way we're used to seeing the doctor act. The companion is acting the way other companions have acted in past seasons. So that is consistent for me. You know, the supporting cast is great. The way they all go on like this Scooby-Doo mystery is great. I think this episode is really fun and is a good representation about what this show is about, as you both mentioned. So I would definitely recommend it. I would definitely recommend it for a new viewer.
I was deciding between casual and new because of everything you guys have said. I agree with. but I think I'm going to go with casual just because I don't know if I'd really introduce this. I like it as some other episodes better that they would watch so they can get more into Doctor Who. But this one's showing the relationship between this doctor and this companion rather than an introduction to the whole show. So it could be near the first ones. I agree with everybody there, but I'm going to go with casual.
New Who.
That was it. Okay.
Got my point across.
For me, I always enjoyed this episode, the first viewing, and I realize that it has some problems, but this is one of the ones that I have more fonder memories in this first season of Capaldi. So I also like that they made a silly thing that the Doctor uses his hand to push the TARDIS out of the way of danger. Watching it again this week with the 12th Doctor's theme playing over that, I was like, good job, you used the right music, you did the right build-up to why the TARDIS is small and why he has the hand be normal-sized. And they just made a silly thing become almost a moment of triumph. So I do like it for that. And for me, I'll put it into a new category as well.
Yeah, I think like it almost works better on its own and getting rid of a bunch of the Danny Clara episodes, because the subtext is there. Like when you have a call and somebody's on a park bench saying, hey, I got the bench, you know what that means. You don't have to be told the story of their relationship up to this point. You know. And so I think it's almost better this episode and kind of if you had just jumped over some of those other ones. Yeah, I'm not arguing anything. I'm just realizing, you know, it's an interesting exercise if you could have gotten rid of some others. Like, just watch this one from the last couple. But I mean, I'm not making that decision yet, but it is interesting to take the cream of the crop and kind of forget about some of the bad ones, which we do.
And then on a side note, this was one of the questions from Doctor Who trivia that where we first met Heather. So I remember one of the questions, I think it was, who is the companion or who is the guest or special character, whatever you want to say, that was a graffiti artist in this episode. And I remember I was like, it sounds like Banksy, but it's not. So I don't know if we got it or not. But
we got it.
Okay, but I do remember this being on the thing, that trivia night.
The only question we lost was Venice.
Yeah, the name of the matron.
Yeah, we got everything else.
And you still only came in second?
We came in second. But I think we won the real first prize in that we got Heather on a podcast.
Yes.
All right, so that wraps up Flatline. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and we'll see you next time when the future becomes the present.
You just listened to an episode of Who Knew?
Our wonderful theme music is by Michael Grady.
Find him on Facebook at The Universe Explodes.
Additional music is by Damiel Paggio.
All our episodes are engineered by Auburn, and you can find him at auburnbinkley.com.
You can also find this show in several places.
Follow us on Twitter at Who Knew Podcast.
Subscribe, review, and listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher.
Or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast.
All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com.
Visit our Facebook page.
Please leave comments, reviews, and click like to support Who Knew Podcast.
To listen to our show on your Amazon Echo device, subscribe to us on Amazon Music.
And then ask your Amazon device to play your podcast subscriptions.
This podcast is inspired by Doctor Who,
the longest-running sci-fi show in history.
And especially the revival spearheaded by Russell T. Davis.
Thanks to Russell, Sidney Newman,
Verity Lambert, Ron Grainer,
and all those involved in the adventures of our favorite Time Lord.
Your work continues to inspire and entertain.